At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, dear listeners, to yet another episode of So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about, hey, you guessed it, board games. First, we're going to talk about the Eurus, the game that we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Then the games we played this week, the news and why it doesn't matter, and the topic of the week, which is asymmetry.
Our favorite factions. We've talked about asymmetry in general.
There's going to be a little bit of...
Sure. But we've already done asymmetry in general.
I'll talk about it later.
Okay, we're gonna live in the controversy. Fine. That's how it's gonna be. So Walker, what did we review last year in our as yet unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus?
I can't talk about it, Mark. It's too icky. Let's see what I did there. That's good.
Is it?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
You can't just say that it's good. That doesn't make it good.
It's the play on words. You see.
It's really not. So, Iki was designed by Kouta Yamada and published by Sorry We Are French, at least in the edition that we have, as of 2015. There was an expansion released, and you really like Iki, don't you?
I do like Iki, and I didn't mind the expansion too much. I saw some of the flaws, like you pointed out, I agree with. But overall, Iki is a fun game.
Iki, I think, is fine. I'm happy to play it, and you indeed have suggested it a number of times since we reviewed it, mostly to play the expansion, frankly, which is not terribly uncommon in the life cycle of preferred Euros. I mean, I'm going to be doing the same thing. I recently got in the expansion for Aquatica, and so that's going to bring it back to the table, such is the nature of things. If you know that there's an audience for it that's willing to play it, a new expansion is a great reason to inject new life into the cycle. But Iki is all right. I mean, the whole structure of the Threat of the Fires seems... too remote and too arbitrary. Like, the only times it ever matters, it seems a little random, and most of the time it doesn't matter, and so that just seems unnecessary. The rondellations are okay. The way it works with a rondelle is okay. It's kind of neat. The timing of retirements is all right, but overall I find it a little too procedural for my taste.
Yeah, the fire product kind of takes you out of it. So you have four districts, and you have a firefighting track. And then so one of those... sections is going to be randomly chosen at the end of the round, and as long as you have your firefighting up to the right point, you can just stop the fire, and if you don't, then it's going to start wading through that whole section.
Right, and you only have to worry about losing a building if it's the case that, number one, you're on the edges, number two, it hits the appropriate district, and number three, there's no mook between you and the fire that has a good enough firefighting
exactly.
Defense. It's kind of like how sometimes in Galaxy Trucker, you can escape the predations of the pirates just because somebody behind you had enough firepower, but there at least your position is determined by other things, and you're benefiting from the fact that you're faster. So it feels less arbitrary in that context. And you know something is going on when my natural association was with Galaxy Trucker when comparing it to a Euro, and my impulse was to say it is less arbitrary than Galaxy Trucker. Not that Galaxy Trucker is exceptionally arbitrary, but it's reasonably arbitrary.
It's
anyway,
true.
Iki's okay.
And that is the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Now on to the games we played this week. Mark, what did you get to play this week?
I played Valka again. Valka is a review copy we got from the publisher, and in multiplayer mode, or in standard two-player mode, it is a card battler where every bizarre, weird, twisted fantasy unit you have has the same summon cost, which is to say no summon cost. The rest of the cards you have are enhancements and or wild events. And I played it multiplayer, and I thought it was some good, stupid fun. And I mean that reasonably flatteringly. As far as, it didn't really feel like a take that card game. It felt a little bit more self-balancing than that, but nonetheless, it's raucous and a whole bunch of wild things happen. You get to see weird effects, and the art by the designer Brooke Penrose is really cool. It reminds me a little bit, a very little bit, of the art style of Dungeon Degenerates or Morkborg, but with a less wild or neon color palette. I'm talking strictly about the pencil work and the inking work. So if you liked the aesthetic of Dungeon Degenerates but wished it had a more sedate color palette, and by more sedate, there's a lot of room between Dungeon Degenerates and...
Yeah, a little wiggle room there.
A little bit, yeah, exactly. Then Valka's art style may be for you. So I was interested in the solo mode, not just because I found the game more interesting than I thought it was going to be, granted a low bar, but nonetheless it cleared it handily, and also because there's a non-trivial number of additional components in the base game box for the solo mode, which led me to believe that perhaps a fair bit of thought had been put into it. So there's a new deck of cards, there's a double layer tracker board to hold D10s as trackers. It's kind of cute with a whole bunch of references on it as well as a linen map board to track where you're going. I did not enjoy the solo mode. It was very arbitrary, very just sort of flip a card, see what happens kind of deal. It did strike me in terms of design as a kind of afterthought. It was also repetitive to boot. And so you're just flipping over cards and seeing what happens. And a lot of it depends on the extent to which the enemies pull in reinforcements. The way that it happens is an enemy can either wound you or it can't. If it can't, there's a 50% chance it's going to bring in another card for reinforcements. And therefore, you're in a position where every turn you basically say, well, either I'm going to have to suffer a wound on one of my fighters, and fighters often only have one or two wounds on them, or I'm just going to have this 50% chance every time of there being a reinforcement. So you end up in these standard holding patterns where you kill the reinforcement, another reinforcement comes in, you kill that reinforcement, another reinforcement comes in, and over again until such time as they just cease to roll new reinforcements often enough that you can actually proceed. And this isn't costly. You're not losing anything in that process. And indeed, you get rewards for all the enemies that you kill. I just didn't find it a particularly satisfying cycle. And so the event cards are the key new thing, the deck of cards explicitly for the solo game. And a lot of them were just nothing happens, or randomly take a damage, or randomly lose a card, or just very predictable, sort of not particularly inventive or in-depth or interesting set of adventure
decks.
Exactly.
Yay.
It didn't really do anything that I thought was particularly interesting, so I don't think that I can recommend Valka as a solo experience. Although, as a multiplayer experience, as I say, it is surprisingly fun and reasonably self-balancing, which, given the overall structure, namely that you only get points for kills, I had grave concerns about, concerns that mostly did not manifest. So that is Valka, wonderful art by the designer Brooke Penrose, published by Terrible Games this year.
I get to put Bus back to the table, and this was possible because a listener was kind enough to send me a copy. This is designed by
Jeroen Desmoulins and Joris Versinger.
Just so. This is a Splatter game from long ago, and now it's on its third printing. It was put out by Splatter first, and now Capstone has put it out twice more. And it is very much a Splatter game, a game where you can destroy your own game, possibly in the first turn, sillily, right? It's possible to do it, but you really wouldn't.
Yeah, you'd have to work, in Bus at least, you'd have to work on it.
And because it has this really weird timing, which we almost screwed up. Luckily, someone caught it and we could just restart quickly, because you are putting workers out much like Dominant Species. You're seeding all these different actions with worker pawns, but you're putting them out in a certain order. They're listed A through B, and you're putting them out, but when they resolve, they always resolve from left to right. But then there's this thing called the maximum bus level, right? So depending on how many people, whoever has the most buses is going to set the power for a lot of these actions.
Doesn't the Book of Revelations talk about the maximum bus level?
It does. It's totally okay. Different, though.
Oh, all right.
And so what we got wrong is that I always thought the first player always got maximum boss level and went down from that. But no, it's always the A player that gets maximum boss level. So even if they're last in line, they get the maximum and it works down from there. So anyway, it's all this like back and forth, figuring out who's going to get the most out of action and where you're going to place your pawns. And turn order very much matters. And then you are bringing people to where they need to go. And, you know, they go from home to work to the bar and then back home and then to work, then to the bar and then back home. It's, you know, much like real life, right? And the fun part about this is that you can stop time. And so you can make them go to work twice in a row. Isn't that nice? So it's all this about setting up where all the buildings are and your bus lines and figuring and trying to get, you know, maximum number of buses up so you can deliver more people. Every time you deliver a passenger, you get points. Points are good. It's a fairly low scoring game. So it's very much cutthroat. Blocking people on, like even if you're placing buildings, you know, and none of them are good for you, well, then you just block other people so they don't get to place buildings where they want to. Anyway, Bus is a fantastic game. Glad I got to the table again.
Got to play Warpgate Beyond. Warpgate Beyond is the card-based expansion to Warpgate, which is the science fiction game by Artem Nechiporov and Wolf Designer, the same designer and publisher of Guards of Atlantis. And I really like it when games are able to be rejuvenated entirely by a new set of cards. So this is an expansion that doesn't just supplement the base game, it completely replaces all the cards from the base game. I didn't think that Warpgate needed fixing, but there's usually room for improvement. This is the same strategy, by the way, that was done for Trickshot 2nd Edition. And in Warpgate Beyond, the key benefit that I see, granted you get new techs, and the techs were already interesting in Warpgate, and I think they're now even more interesting. The key benefit is the objective cards. The objective cards in Warpgate were valuable, worth pursuing, but not particularly exciting or interesting, so it was very consequential. But some of the new objective cards in Warpgate Beyond are downright cool. And so it really is a question of looking at the objectives you've got and trying to triage the ones that are viable and being very concerned about the end of the game, because some of them are about holding dirt. Just, you know, have occupied certain set of planet or planets at the end of the game. Others are slightly different, but they all adhere at the end of the game, so you have to be careful. And this emphasizes a certain degree of defense that otherwise doesn't adhere, because one of the interesting things about Warpgate, there are a lot of interesting things about Warpgate, you get mission cards through the process of grabbing certain planets. But then, if you don't have any objectives corresponding to those planets, you have no reason to hold them, except as a way to keep them from other players. And so there's a certain amount of doublethink that therefore emerges, but that's not the primary driver of what's going on. The primary appeal to me of Warpgate is that it is kind of midway between the hyper-stripped down science fiction-y games like your Quantum and getting you some more of the trappings of your full-on 4XE style space games like your Eclipse or your Twilight's Imperium. And I find it very satisfying also just as a sort of rough analog to a Troops on the Map game as well. I really love the combat system. I love how you can upgrade your combat deck, and there's a certain amount of doublethink going on there as well, insofar as what to play, because every card has a trade-off between how effective it is in battle and what special effect that it generates. Sometimes you play a card just for the special effect. Sometimes you play a card just for the battle effect. It's tough to say. And on top of that, as I've mentioned, what you want out of a fight can vary considerably based on what the overall map state is. Anyway, I'm a big fan of the work of Artem Nechiporov, and Warpgate is no exception. I liked Warpgate. I like Warpgate Beyond even more, and I was happy to get it to the table again.
I got Dinosaur World back to the table. This is by Panosaurus Games, designed by Brian Lewis and David McGregor with Marissa Mazura. And so Panosaurus Games first put out Dinosaur Island, and all you had was a bunch of sort of dinosaur attractions. And the main mechanism was how many of the people coming to the park are going to die. As you pull them out of the bag, you have security level, and you had hooligans that came to your park. But in Dinosaur World, it's all about mostly just building your park, because you have more attractions than just dinosaurs. You have Ferris wheels and restaurants and all sorts of different things. And as you're putting them out on this hex grid, you're going to do this like sort of like a little Jeep tour. You're going to move your Jeep around the park and you're going to hit all of these things. In comes one of the worst mechanisms I've witnessed in a board game recently, is this boredom level. And you're constantly up tracking all these different locations that you visit, because, you know, people get bored of them, so you have to keep ticking these tokens down.
Mm. The fun part was that, you know, I hadn't had it out for a while. So I opened the box. And it's like, oh, there's this whole bag of little mini dice that I had purchased instead of the tokens. It's like, oh, yeah, I forgot I bought these for this game. And so it's like, oh, we get to use these finally. So anyway, I love Dinosaur World. Everyone who played it as well, I introduced it to a bunch of new people, also enjoyed it. It's just a very interesting sort of, we get to build a dinosaur park and we get to populate it with dinosaurs. You're actually buying DNA and you're, you know, mixing it all together to make these cool dinosaurs. You can even have these hybrids, and we play with all of the expansions because we hardly ever get it to the table. So it's like, it's like, we're going to play with all these because some of them don't add too much, just more dinosaurs. And some of them add a bit too much, like the underwater ones where you have to fight against this algae attack against your park for the whole thing. You think boredom's bad. This algae thing is ridiculous. Anyway, good times were had by all. Glad I got it to the table. Would play again. Still going to keep it. Dinosaur World, super fun.
So let me get this straight. You, in this dinosaur park, you build all these other attractions.
Yes.
Okay. I have two questions. Number one, why would you go on a Ferris wheel when you could go see a dinosaur?
Because sometimes the dinosaurs don't come right up to the fence. And now you're on this giant Ferris wheel, so you get to look down into the middle of their habitats, and you get to see what they do when they're not right up at the gates. You
okay.
See?
Excellent, excellent, excellent reply. Question the second, why would you go to an amusement park that might kill you? I don't understand why you would go to a dinosaur park that might kill you, because you don't really have an alternative. If you're going to go see the dinosaurs, they might kill you. But why would you go to an amusement park and go to the other attractions if you might die in the process?
The word might is very tricky there. See, there was no might in my park. My park, you know, you're taking your life in your hands.
It was a charnel house.
It's the same thing as, why do people skydive? Why do people do all these other things? It's this thrill of excitement, Mark.
Okay.
Knowing that it might happen. Like when you're playing the Triceratops ring toss and you might get hooked under your chin with a horn from the, you know,
it's
all this excitement.
Nothing. You know, you make a compelling case.
It's always an exciting day at the dinosaur park. You know, you don't even have to go on any rides.
I couldn't
help. You just walk around and watch the carnage that
I couldn't
happens.
Help but notice that at your dinosaur park, there were turnstiles for the entry, but there was no exit because you didn't need one. It was regarded as superfluous. So
it's just a lot of buckets.
Yeah, good to know. Played another game of Scout. Scout is by Kei Kijino, and I got to try the non-Oikin Games version. Did you know that there's a mass market version of Scout?
Yes, I did. I've seen it. It's like a Walmart version.
Exactly.
It comes in like this longer box.
Yeah, it's the standard kind of double-wide deck of cardboard box. There are cards now for the Scout tickets, and you have to keep score with a pen and paper or with some sort of tracking app. So,
gross.
Well, the Oink Games box is undeniably adorable, and it does actually come with tokens. However, it is not as commonly available as the mass market version. I was vaguely curious about the mass market version. At least it preserves the very, very minor element of theming that the first original printing did not have. You still have the names of all the performers, and you still have all their specialties. So you get to talk about how Joanne was shot out from a cannon, or you're scouting Matthew because of his proficiency with the stilts.
Nice.
So there's something there. You know, it may sound like nothing. It's close to nothing, but it's not nothing. And I was pleased to see that the fundamental gameplay, of course, remains as satisfying as ever. And it's good that they kept the Oink Games artwork. Scout is a marvelous climbing game where you're not allowed to rearrange your hand, but in the process of scouting various people's cards, you get to build that tremendous combination. So you may start off with a 3-5-7. Well, if you can find the 4 and the 6, if you can scout those out, well, suddenly you've got a run. And on that topic, I was able to do something that I was never able to do before. I completed a run that was almost what we would call the full Monty. It went from 2 to 10. Now that won me the round, as you might imagine. I still lost embarrassingly, but nonetheless, that I worked for it. I worked hard.
It's a moral victory.
It is a moral victory. Now, in the process, I should note, one of the reasons why I lost horribly was because most of those cards came from the same player, the player to my right. And so consequently, I would just fed him a whole bunch of points in the process of being able to build that hand. So it's conceivable that that run from 2 to 10 benefited him more than it did me. I didn't bother to stop to do the math. As you say, it was a moral victory. That is Scout.
Speaking of small card games, I really love these games that are coming out by Mandu Games, the Jekyll versus Hyde. I got to play Jekyll and Hyde versus Scotland Yard.
So what Jekyll versus Hyde is, it's a trick-taking game where you're sort of setting the trump every time you play. If I play, you know, a spade first, then spade's going to be the lowest trump. And then as the suits are played, you're assigning how powerful those particular suits are. And then you're not always trying to win. One player plays Jekyll. They're trying to make sure both players, it's a two-player game, they're trying to make sure both players are winning equal numbers of tricks. Whereas Hyde just wants the game to swing one way or the other because he's trying to get off the map and he's going to move a number of spaces equal to the difference in tricks. So he's trying to either lose all of their tricks or win all of their tricks. And it's this great back and forth. There's some potions in there, which are special abilities, a little bit like, you know, Regicide, where the, you know, the particular suit has a special ability. Anyway, moving on to the game that I'm actually talking about, Jekyll and Hyde versus Scotland Yard. It's a cooperative game. And the one player is just playing off the top of their deck after you feed them a bunch of really high cards. And you're just trying to, once again, whichever of the two players wins the least number of tricks, that is going to be how far you move down the track. And you're just trying to keep ahead of Scotland Yard. And there's all these different chapters that you're working through. And it's nice because it sort of teaches more and more of the game. You know, you're just doing the basic game, chapter one, and you start adding more and more rules as you go along. It's a great little game. Another Mandu production designed by
Gaetan Bourgeonnet, Olivier Sipierre, and Genil.
Perfect. And all of these copies have, the artist is Vincent Dutrait, so you have great looking production there.
Been playing more games of Cthulhu Death May Die Fear of the Unknown. This, I think, is rapidly solidifying its place as possibly the group's favorite sort of cooperative, silly, let's go kill things with some additional scenario elements involved, partially because of the tone. It is reliably amusing. The different scenarios offer a fair bit of texture, and they don't really add much to the setup time, and so that I very much appreciate. We played three different scenarios now from the base game. I have to say that the first two were very solid. The third one that we finished last, it struck me as a little uneven because the way the map is set up, it's basically one long tunnel. You have to go and pick up objectives from the end of the tunnel and then sort of deposit them, and they're layers on top of the skill checks and so forth related to the depositing in a variety of ways. That part's all fine, except for the fact that at near the end of the tunnel, there is a spawn point that just spews out a near endless stream of monsters.
Yeah, and between the objectives and where the objectives need to go.
Exactly. And consequently, it really feels like it's either a bit of a slog or you really have to have the right skill set. The investigators you take have to have stealth in order for it to make much sense. And it worked. I mean, it's not as if the scenario completely failed. It's just the specific combination didn't show the game system to its strengths. This is not uncommon in a scenario-based game, and I have to say that the ratio of hits to near misses in Cthulhu Death May Die is much, much better than a lot of other game systems. But it wasn't ideal. This didn't seem like the preferred way to do it. This in no way cools my enthusiasm for the game system. I have yet to consolidate all the material from Fear of the Unknown with the base game. I am optimistic I might be able to get it down to 3 boxes, maybe? I don't know. If it can only get down to 4, at that point there's no point. But we'll see what happens. Maybe if it can't be consolidated down to lower than 4, I might just have to think of another solution. It's an issue. But nonetheless, I'm happy with all the stuff that I've got. And Cthulhu Death May Die remains, I think, one of the smartest stupid games I've ever played. Although we have yet to, you complained earlier, and I think it's true, Walker, we have yet to encounter another scenario in which we strap explosives to farm animals. So we haven't quite reached those heights ever again. This is Cthulhu Death May Die, Fear of the Unknown, a.k.a. Seasons 3 and 4, designed by Rob Davio, Eric Lang, and Marco Portugal. This, of course, is Coolmany or Not, so we're not really sure to what extent Rob Davio and Eric Lang had any participation in Seasons 3 and 4. I suspect Marco Portugal might have done the lion's share, but tough to tell.
I get to bring Set a Watch back to the table. Set a Watch is a cooperative game where you're picking characters, you're rolling your 3 dice, and depending on how your character works, they could be anywhere from D4s to D12s, and then you sort of use those dice to attack a line of creatures or to activate abilities that are in your card, and it's a puzzle game where you're trying to figure out the most effective way to get rid of that line of creatures while not using up all your dice too fast and taking too many hits, because you have three ability spots every character. There always has to be four. So collectively, the group has 12 hit points. And everything that goes bad makes you lose one of your abilities, i.e. one of your hit points. And you turn over when all the characters have taken, when you've taken a 12 hits, then you lose the game. So both times we lost on the last location. You're working through a set of locations, which is terrible. We got there. Didn't quite finish off though. The second game was not even close. Two of the characters got taken out just before the last line even started. And then it was just downhill from there.
Wait, there's player elimination?
Yes.
Oh, I'd forgotten that.
The game we streamed also got to the end, but we sort of worked through most of the line, but didn't finish all the way through. I think it works best at three because one character does have to tend the fire every round. Normally, the very last round, everyone goes, but you know, for the eight rounds before that, one person has to do camp actions. Not as exciting. So I think it works best at three. That way you're sort of subbing out one of your characters if your character's going to the fire. Anyway, still love Set a Watch. It's one of those things where I don't know if I'm doing it or if it's the right thing to do. You sort of have to offset. I've invested this much money into this product. I would like to get a table a few more times. So it's like, I have bought a lot of Set of Watch. I'm very glad I got to the table again to sort of offset that range, I guess.
Yes, I believe you are articulating the sunk cost fallacy. Played Hamster Roll. Hamster Roll is by Jacques Zemet. What a genius Jacques Zemet is. There's an art to making something very, very light and approachable, which is characteristic of a lot of Jacques Zemet designs. He has done Cockroach Poker, he has done Ghost Blitz, and he's also done Hamster Roll. This isn't a new edition. It used to be a giant wooden wheel. Now it is a very large wooden wheel. It is a dexterity game where you are stacking things up in your... There's this pressure due to a variety of simple rules that force you to place further and further along on the wheel, and that causes the wheel to roll, as one might expect. And if this rolling causes any previously placed pieces to dislodge, those you have to keep, and it is a shedding dexterity game. You want to get rid of all your pieces. And there's a lot of interesting judgment involved. Tension is someone's shaking hand. I mean, my shaking hands, not Walker's shaking hands. Above the precipice, wondering if the weight is going to hold, trying to evaluate how much give there is in the given wheel. It's pretty good for a spectacle. It's not just the question of a piece falling from the top or some sort of collapse of a stack. The rolling of the wheel is very nice. These lovely moments where the wheel is wobbling and you don't know if any pieces are going to get dislodged.
Because, you know, not only do you have to, you know, test the weight of the piece that you're going to put on, you have to see how many pieces are going to fall. Because if any of this makes too much noise, this summons the hamsters. You don't want that to happen. That's a mess.
I was not informed of that part.
Oh, it's the exciting part. You don't tell the people that it's going to happen. You just wait for it to happen.
Okay. I remember when I first got started in the hobby, this is sort of a weird luxury item because it was only available from Germany and the shipping was exorbitant because, as I say, originally it was quite a large wheel. Now it is much more accessible. It was recently reprinted in a smaller, cheaper edition, and it's available domestically more easily, which is great. Jacques Zemet makes wonderful light little bagatelles. I highly recommend it. Hamster Roll.
Federation, designed by Dimitri Pechier and Mathieu Vader, put out by Explore 8. We enjoy Federation, and this was no change. Played it on Board Game Arena. They have a great implementation there. You're sort of voting in the Senate, and there's many different reasons why you'd want to vote on either side or different levels or how you vote. You can either, you know, put in numbers of votes, or you can fund instead on the other side of your token, which advances end of game scoring conditions. Lots of decisions. But it was pointed out to me, and I sort of agree, that it gets a little samey after a while, right? There's not much to discover in Federation, but I still enjoy it. It's a nice game to bring out every so often. It wouldn't be a game that you want to play over and over again for those reasons. There are two sides of the board which mixes it up, plus tokens that also cover, but it pretty well changes the same thing every time. It'll change the technologies that are on the top of the board. Anyway, Federation, if you have a chance to try it out, it is a great production. These giant poker chips, double-sided, depending on how you want to use your senators. Lots to do. Lots of tracks. Tracks on tracks. And there's tracks that also sort of track how those tracks are moving.
It's true.
It's true. That is not being sarcastic. Federation.
Got to introduce Walker to my favorite Seiji Kanai game. He is perhaps best known for Love Letter, but I really enjoy his card game R, which was republished as Brave Rats in North America. It consists merely of 14 cards, and thus I keep it in my purse, and I carry it with me wherever I go. It is a two-player game. Each player has the same set of 7 cards, and they have a numerical value from 1 to 7, and they have a special ability. And every round, each player chooses one card. Higher value wins. Win 4 rounds. So it's all about the special abilities. And the great thing about how parsimonious the universe of effects is that it doesn't take long for players to internalize what all the available cards do, and thus there's some pretty satisfying doublethink. For example, the classic exchange that I enjoy very much is somebody plays the Warlord, which is value 6, which is great, and then next round you get a +2 bonus to whatever card you play. Ah, but there's a card that's value 3 called the Assassin, which says whoever played the lowest value card wins this particular round. And the way those two dovetail works very, very well. But then you might think, but if somebody plays that 3, they get the +2 added to it. That makes it a 5. Do you expect the opponent to go all out and play the highest card they can and attempt to beat your Warlord advantage? Or are you instead going to do something else? And this is on top of the fact of the core interaction in R, which is that the prince is value 7 and has a special ability that just says he wins the round flat. So if I play my 7, my prince, and you counter with your 3 card that says the lower card wins, well, guess what? My special ability trumps yours. I just win. But the 1 card is the princess. And if you play the 1 against the 7, you just win the entire game. It's not even the question of the rounds. I love R. It's great. Very quick. Very easy to explain. What was your impression of R, Walker?
I very much enjoy it. It has a part of poker that is not usually focused on. There's a lot to do with poker when someone gets beat bad or they get killed on the river, they lose a hand or they win a hand, and how they play the next hand.
Mm.
It's not something that's talked about a lot, but it's not as though it's a secret just to me or to a few people. It is
right.
It's just something that's not really talked about. And that is very much in this game. When you see how people react to losing a hand, you might figure out what they're going to play next. They might be a little frustrated. They might think, well, I'm not going to lose my next big card or something. And they're going to play small. It's this figuring out what the other person's going to do. Very poker-like. And like you said, once the second game comes along, you've internalized your whole hand and you can sort of set up, how I'm going to play the next few turns.
Also got to show Walker Lost Cities, the board game. To my surprise, people in our immediate environments possibly haven't even played the original Lost Cities card game. The original Lost Cities card game by Reinhard Knizia is a perennial classic of two-player gaming and was published about 25 years ago. The board game is the multiplayer version. It is an adaptation of Celtis, which is Reinhard Knizia's SDJ-winning game. And the Lost Cities version, as done by Rio Grande Games, turns it into a 3-round game rather than 1-round game and changes one of the rules with respect to what eligible cards are playable. And for what it's worth, I think they're largely for the better. And instead of having to engage in a whole bunch of math in Lost Cities, you are going up tracks. It is a very tracky game, but that's all you're doing, so it's perhaps defensible. You play a card from one of the 5 suits, and that allows you to advance your adventure up a track. The track starts out at negative points, so starting an adventure carries with it some risk. But once you cross a certain threshold, it's all points. But the trick is that you can only ever play a card that is equal to or higher than any card you've already played of that suit. So go ahead and play that 6. You can start an expedition on a 6, and sometimes you have to, with the full knowledge that means 1 through 5 are completely unplayable to you, and possibly also guaranteeing that that is the next card you're going to draw. And Lost Cities has one of those things that I take to be very characteristic of Reinhard Knizia card games, which is the desperate desire to pass or just be able to discard a card to cycle. But every card you discard in Lost Cities in both versions of the game, those are available for everybody else. You may have played the 6 gold, and so that 3 gold you pulled is of no use to you. But you look around the table and say, oh, great, Huey's only on the 2 gold, and so the 3 would be perfect for him. Oh, what do I do with all this garbage? Lost Cities is great. What did you think, Walker?
I loved it. It's very, I don't want to say luck dependent, but what you draw off the top of the deck really will either make or make you very frustrated. We only flipped the table twice, so that's not bad. that's great. You really want, to make nice. You want to get to the end because, man, do those points, ramp up. That was the first 3 or 4 are negative points.
Yep.
So if you're going to start down a road, you better you better make it down that road before the end happens, or else, you know, you get negative points instead. So there was some fairly swingy rounds where someone was like, by someone, I mean me, someone was 20, 30, 40 points, and someone was 110, 120 points.
It's tricky. The timing is tricky. There is a fair amount of luck of the draw, true, but like with many Knizia games, if you set yourself up properly, you're going to find that the deck is going to be giving you what you need more often than if you're sloppy. And I really appreciate how the overall structure works, because the base Lost Cities game was very mathy in a way that was perhaps a little less evocative or satisfying for many people. And I really like the fact that now it's just a flat scoring track. It's much easier to calculate. And there's some extra little bennies on the side. I really like Keltis and all its derivatives. There's an Oracle variant of Keltis that I quite like. New Ways, the first expansion of Keltis, is just not particularly interesting when compared to the others. But other than that, everything that's been done with the system, I thought, is really pretty cool. And so I was glad to introduce you to Lost Cities, the board game. I also want to give a plug to Lost Cities Rivals, which is a strange titling. Normally, in Euro games, you start off with the multiplayer game, and then you call Rivals the two-player version of it. This is the exact opposite. Lost Cities Rivals is the multiplayer card game version of Lost Cities, but it has an auction system that's kind of neat. It's one of the closed economy auctions where all the money just keeps getting passed around. I thoroughly enjoy Lost Cities. I kind of played it to death because I was with a roommate who just wanted to play it over and over and over and over again. And no slight to her, she was a very clever person, but she wasn't very good at Lost Cities. I could always get her to discard whatever it is that I wanted. I just wouldn't start my strongest expedition, and I would know for a fact that she would discard those cards sooner or later. And so I just waited, and sure enough, they showed up. And it was, so I kind of burnt out on the base game Lost Cities as a consequence, but all the board game derivatives and all the Keltis versions are really great. Finally, we played Vengeance, Roll, and Fight. This is by Gordon Kalea, friend of the show, Norley Lubbers, and David Terze, published by Mighty Boards. This is the roll and write-ish kind of sort of almost but not really variation on Vengeance, the revenge movie board game. It has a lot less thematic integration than Vengeance does. Vengeance really does a great job of making you feel like you're in a revenge movie. You go through all the terrible, terrible tortures inflicted on you by gang members. And Vengeance, Roll, and Fight aggressively leans away from that level of detail, even in places where they could. I constantly point out that the character card that you're dealt at the top of the game, the character you're playing as, has a deficiency, a defect, or a drawback. They could have very easily just described that as an injury, as the cause of the wronging, but they didn't bother, so there's that. But what you get is a shockingly interesting real-time dice programming game, where you have all these recipes that do various effects, like this allows you to damage a goon in an adjacent room, this allows you to move, or this allows you to charge, or you can buy new recipes, and you're just rolling the dice as fast as you can to satisfy them. The moment you satisfy a recipe, you don't do anything right away, you just get to grab more dice from the common pool until the common pool is gone. Now, unfortunately, one of the challenges of Vengeance, Roll, and Fight, I've commented on this before, because it's a real-time competitive game, everyone needs to understand how everything works before it starts. And the recipe satisfying conditions and the way the dice work, and the fact that you then later on cash them in for effects in whatever order you want, strikes some people as counterintuitive. And so some people, even who've played the game before, need to be reminded of the fundamental structure all over again. And sometimes in the middle of the frenetic dice rolling, people get confused, and that's somewhat unfortunate. So it does not have the approachability that a lot of roll and write games have, but for my money, it is much more interesting and absolutely worth the additional rules overhead.
I agree. It is super fun. You get very interesting abilities, and you get to power them up, and unlike sort of Project Elite, which is real time and you're like sort of upgrading on the go, like during the time limit, this one, they sort of have the interlude in between where you roll the dice, everyone sort of takes what they want from there, and you buy your new abilities, and then you're ready to go, and you sort of set your plan. You look at your little map, because everyone has their own little different building that they're slaughtering through, and you can either do like you do good on range, good on hand to hand, and you sort of said, okay, I need about three moves, and then the rest is just going to be carnage, and you roll as fast as you can, because like Mark said, it's a common pool, so the faster you roll, the faster you lock in all the things that you want to do, the faster you get more dice from the pool, the less dice other players will have.
There is a fair amount of luck of the draw involved. After round one, Huey was really behind the eight ball, because you roll wounds, and wounds don't give you anything by and large. And you have to suffer a wound to reroll all the wounds, and it's just, but you have only three wounds to start the game with. It's really, really tight. And so I feel like early, very bad luck can really cripple you, but it's definitely worth it. I have a blast every time I play Vengeance Roll and Fight. I think it is one of my favorite games of the Roll and Write derivatives. It's not quite a Roll and Write game, but it's trading on some of the same ideas in really genuinely interesting ways. I highly recommend it.
You're rolling. You're writing. You know, what do you want?
That's Vengeance Roll and Fight.
Those are the games we played this week.
And now a brief break to pay some bills. And we're back.
Mark, we love Freeman Freeze. We love trick-taking games.
I've never met the man. I mean, maybe I don't. Maybe I wouldn't like him.
We love the designs of Freeman Freeze.
There you go.
It's called...
Well, not all of them.
Freeman Freeze's Fishing.
Freeman Freeze's Fishing?
Yes, because it has to start with an F. It's the way he rolls. So it's a trick-taking game by Freeman Freeze. Actually, there's a ton of news this week. Not from us. Spiel just ended. Guess what? All of the games are out.
It's true.
So if you're very interested, you can go online. I'm going to pick just a few of the ones that stood out to me, as in this one. Freeman Freeze, trick-taking game. I want to play it.
You're already in. Similarly, I will point out once again that Matt Gertz released a game called Seven Empires at Spiel. This is a game that is loosely inspired by the structure of Imperial, in that individual players are not specific nations, not any of the eponymous Seven Empires, but instead get a kind of sort of pseudo-stock system through a drafting mechanism, and it is largely a question of which nations you're quote-unquote invested in doing well to determine how many victory points you get. But this time, unlike Imperial, on top of all the economic differences, not all the empires are created equal. Some of them have vastly greater potential for success, and they reward comparatively fewer victory points. So there's an interesting risk-reward element there. I am a massive, massive fan of the games of Matt Gertz. I can't wait to try it. Seven Empires.
So when was the last time Matt Gertz put out a game? It seems like it's been a while.
Well, there was Transatlantic, and then the redevelopment of Transatlantic. It's been a couple years.
All right. Well, we like Reiner Knizia.
Well, we have never met him. He seems like a nice guy, but
we like the designs of Reiner Knizia.
Well, most of them. I mean, many of them. We haven't even played most of them.
Kingdoms was a game he put out. It is being re-implemented.
Heller of Fetting.
It is being implemented as a game called Cosmolancer. Boy, that sounds exciting. Eh?
That game has been redesigned and redeveloped so many times. I remember there was a Beowulf the movie version of it, which, setting aside the awfulness of the Beowulf movie, I haven't seen it, but it looks terrible. Literally, as in it looks terrible. The big problem is Reiner Knizia has two Beowulf games. One of them is awesome and an original adaptation of the epic, and another is like a three times reheated abstract tiling thing that's a cheap movie tie-in. You can keep going.
That's all I got.
That's all you got?
Cryolancer. For those who like Kingdoms and that other...
Yeah, it's about taking pictures of space whales.
There you go.
I'm sure the theme is redolent. So Burned. Burned is a two-player cat-and-mouse hidden movement game that we very much enjoyed. We played a prototype version from Stone Circle Games. It is being relaunched on crowdfunding on October the 23rd. I will definitely be pledging for it once again. Let's hope for better success this time. Burned was great.
Burned was great. Speaking of asymmetric, as we will be later, this is one of the good two-player asymmetric card games. Anyway, on to Transgalactica. This is another Devier Games and Daniel Tizzini conglomeration. They have yet to disappoint. Looking forward to more from Devier. Chonkers Party, Mark. We like big bears. We like giant animals. Now there's going to be a card game, a party trick-taking game where you're giving treats to pets to make them super chonkers. I'm in. Chonker Party. And lastly, I just want to throw in there, I talked about Federation earlier in the games we played this week. I was on an episode of Boards and Brews where we also talked about Federation. So if you want more Mike Walker content, check out that podcast. It is by The Hungry Gamer. He does all the sort of, you know, crowdfunding preview videos, which he does a great job of. So check it out. Boards and Brews.
Finally, there's something we like to commemorate here on So Very Wrong About Games. On October the 27th, 1962, a man by the name of Vasily Arkhipov saved the entire world when he stood up to his two commanding officers and refused to authorize a nuclear attack on the United States of America during the Cuban Missile Crisis. In so doing, Robert McNamara, the defense secretary at the time, later said that he single-handedly saved the entire world, and consequently, everyone listening to this podcast as well. It is a shame that he does not get more recognition. I think he deserves a statue in every major city and in every corner of the globe, but until then, he's going to have to suffer the indignity of merely being commemorated by arguably one of the 10 best podcasts in Kingston, Ontario. So, October the 22nd will be the 62nd anniversary of Vasily Arkhipov saving the entire human race. We call it Arkhipov Day. I think it is a moment of reflection on power, violence, and knowing when to exercise them and how, and the consequences of our actions. Please join me in celebrating this. You will be hearing about this again on So Very Wrong About Games. October 27th, Arkhipov Day. And that is the news. And why it doesn't matter. We now move on to our topic, which apparently we have some disagreement as to what it is.
I don't.
Okay.
But when researching, I was like, I don't think some people understand what the difference between asymmetric and variances are.
True.
Like, would you call a deck-building game asymmetric game?
Well, generally no, but sometimes some deck-building games, people start off with different powers. Like, for example, in Imperium, everybody starts with a different deck, and sometimes there are even abilities coded into some of those cards that don't exist in other areas. I considered briefly whether I was going to mention in my favorite factions, my favorite Imperium factions, but I love them all too much.
Can't just pick one child.
I was thinking about it. It's like, wow, I love Imperium so much. Imperium is great. Every nation feels so different in many ways, or at least the more complicated ones do, but I just couldn't pick a favorite. I was leaning towards the Sassanids, but then it's like, no, I also like the Morians really a whole. Anyway, it's a whole story.
So asymmetric is defined as things that are different, things that are not the same. So normally I would just say, and is it always when you start the game off? Is asymmetric games only? Would you call?
No, it doesn't have to be.
I have. Where do we have here? Blood Rage. Would you call Blood Rage an asymmetric game? Because if you are changing your tableau, only certain players will have monsters.
If there's a specific ability in Blood Rage that you really want to talk about, then yeah, I think it's fair game.
No, I meant just the monsters that you will socket into your tableau that no one else will have because there's only one.
I agree. Fenrir is amazing.
Agreed.
Fenrir is definitely the bestest moon-swallowing wolf that one can have.
And then we have Food Chain Magnet.
Oh, the Milestones?
Milestones.
Yeah, if there's a Milestone
things,
you want to talk. Yeah. You're like favorite faction, favorite bit of asymmetry, favorite whatever. Like, yeah. I mean, part of this, you suggested this topic, and one of the reasons why I was inclined to take it was because the last game we reviewed, Andromeda's Edge, promised a lot of character and failed to deliver, frankly. I mean, one of the factions is called, and I quote, Jelluloid Technoblorps. But nonetheless, playing as the Jelluloid Technoblorps is just kind of, you know,
it sounds
whatever.
Exciting.
Yeah, it sounds exciting, but, you know, it writes a check that you can't really cash. So we started with some games that we have both played, and we both wanted to talk about our favorite factions therein.
Yes, a listener suggested this topic. So the suggestion was, what are your favorite asymmetric faction powers or abilities or armies or people?
Sure.
And so,
well, I don't have a list of my favorite people here.
There are lots of, like I said, I grouped them up. There were so many different groups here. Like, all dungeon crawlers are asymmetric. They have conflict games.
Like all focus, Walker, focus.
I'm just saying, like, historical war games, like coin games, they're all asymmetrical too.
Yep.
Anyway, let's just skip all this other stuff that I wrote down here. And we will just go to the ones that we picked that we have our favorite ones. Let's start with Scythe.
Sure. What's your favorite faction in Scythe, Walker?
Polonia is my favorite. A lot of these are going to be not even based. A lot of people base them on, I like playing them because I always win or they have the best things that help.
I think it's fair to say that for both of us, it's not going to be, these are the strongest ones. These are the ones I feel where I get the highest score.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Polonia is great because I feel the best part for Scythe for me are the adventure cards. There's so much, you know, depth in there with the art and the different options.
Yep.
And when you bring a leader to one of these adventure sites, you get to read a card and pick one of the three different things. But with Polania, you get to pick 2. So you're incentivized to get to more of these adventure sites, which is more fun.
Yeah, you're encouraged to do the cool thing more often. The only thing, the only countervailing balance of that is there's less tension because you can typically compensate for whatever the first option doesn't give you or pay for the cost of the first option with your second option. But yeah, I love playing Polonia as well. It's not my favorite though. My favorite is Clan Albion because it's got a great pig. And because I love being able to drop those flags because I find it very cumbersome in the context. Cumbersome isn't the right word. I find it difficult. I'm not well suited to that balance that you have in a lot of troops on a map game. Not that Scythe is a troop on a map game. To know when it's time to pivot from expansion into consolidation. And when playing Clan Albion, you don't have to worry about that. Drop a flag, you never need to come back. Yeah, I mean, you can if you want to. And you might have to if enemies press on you. But you can just keep pressing the boundary forward with the sort of reassurance that all those terrains that you left behind get to count as yours at the end of the game as well. That, and you got a great pig.
Great pig.
Did I mention the pig?
The pig.
The pig's great.
So
I like Albion.
For the asymmetric parts of Scythe, we've both talked about sort of the main ability of the faction. But on top of that, every starting position in Scythe offers different sort of resources and how they're spaced out. And also the mechs. Every faction has 4 mechs and they all have special abilities as well. So lots of asymmetry in Scythe.
It's true.
Next, we'll talk about Gaia Project. Lots in Gaia Project. They also, just the expansion just
I'm
arrived.
I'm mostly humoring you.
Just, I know. I understand that.
One of my problems is, I was looking over the factions again for Gaia Project, and so many factions have no power at all until you build their resource institute.
It's
your,
true.
Sorry, your planetary institute, which is very expensive and hard to do. And so I never feel like taking those because it feels like I'm wasting my time.
It's true. I don't know if it's the strategy, but a lot of times I get that out in the first round. Just
really?
So you can start. Yeah.
That's impressive.
There is weight. There are a lot of sacrifices will be made.
Sure, Mark. Sure.
But in order to start, you know, leaning into. So, like I was about to say, the expansion just arrived this morning. So even more factions getting. I mean, I am kind of excited to read through them and see what they can do. So in Gaia Project, it is a space. You're moving out into space. You have a faction that likes a particular type of planet. Terraforming is a big part of Gaia Project. And so, you know, you terraform easily on your home planet, and then there's sort of like a graded ladder, and so positioning where you are and how you shoot, you know, how you push out into space to try to get to those easier planets is great. And I really feel as though in this particular game, if you want to do well, leaning into special powers is the way to do that.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why, for what it's worth, we talked about this actually when talking about asymmetry. There's the kind of asymmetry that allows you to play with new stuff. And then there's the kind of asymmetry that kind of encourages you to focus and drill down on the thing you're good at. And both of those are fine. I'm not criticizing. It's just the latter kind I find a little more limiting than other kinds of asymmetry. And I think Gaia Project kind of falls into that category. But I've said enough about Gaia. What is your favorite faction in Gaia Project, Walker?
My favorite faction are the robots. They are called the Besekkods, the Bcods.
I don't speak their language. You can call them whatever you want.
Anyway, I like them because they just get free techs. Knowledge is very hard to sort of acquire in this game without, you know, making huge sacrifices. And what they let you do is if you're the lowest on a particular tech tree, you get to move up that for free. That is why I like them. Although I should say the other interesting part about Gaia Project is that you... No one will be going for the planet that you have because the black planets that the robots want, the other faction that wants them is on the other side of the card. So there's right. No way they're both going to be out there. And sort of seeing what planets are beside each other are very important. Anyway, love the robots. They're fun to play.
For me, this is a rarity. 9 times out of 10 in a science fiction context or a fantasy context, humans are kind of boring and generic. But for me, my favorite faction in Gaia Project is the Terrans because... My favorite game detail in both Gaia Project and Terra Mystica and all those derivatives is cycling power. Cycling power is fun. It's cool. It's a neat alternative to other forms of currency, and you can trade it in for all kinds of things. The Terrans, get to cycle directly from the Gaia pool into stage two, bypassing stage one. So they're cycling power faster. And in the process, they also get free stuff. So you get free stuff, which is great, and cycle power. So you get to engage with the power cycling more frequently than other powers do. So I really like playing as the Terrans. And this is unusual. Most of the time in these science fiction games, the Terrans are boring. But here, they're great.
Well, that leads to my second favorite, which is that the faction that has that weird crystal that goes into the pool.
Yes.
And it counts as three. So that's, you know, and you just cycle that one over around and around and just
utilize the crystal, that. The crystal faction's pretty good, too. Yeah.
Next, let's talk about Root, because I think that's a fan favorite. And
really? People like Root?
I think so.
Do you think people like it enough to spark a visual design trend that's going to dominate crowdfunding for 5 years?
Maybe. And be like the poster child for asymmetry in board games?
Yeah, that too.
That could be it.
Yeah, maybe.
My favorite, Mark, is the Eerie. The birds.
You like the birds?
I love the birds.
You love the birds.
It's sort of like a runaway freight train.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, what, I think it's called steam. It's not steampunk. What's that race game where you're just like hacking together a car? Steampunk Rally? You're sort of like just, you know, riveting all these different rockets and stuff onto your car.
Right.
And just shooting it off, because that's what you're doing is the birds. It's just like, and on top of that, Mark, you get to use that as an excuse. You know, the wine comes in. Why are you attacking me? And you're like, I'm sorry, but the people have spoken, Mark. The people have spoken.
The decree mandates that I have to attack you here. Yeah.
Exactly. It says I must attack, so therefore I must attack. And that's how the birds work. You start laying out all these actions, and you must perform these actions or else you go into disarray. And every turn you have to add another card. So you just, this train starts building up steam, and you're just figuring out ways. How am I going to do all these different actions in my turn? And I love the birds.
The birds are great. It is a very interesting and novel form of action programming that is very much unlike what a lot of other factions do in games generally. But at the same time, the rules overhead is practically negligible. Like, everyone at the table can immediately understand how the birds add to their decree and how the decree works. The only part of confusion is that some people continuously get tripped up as to the move rule about whether it's move to or move from. And I constantly have to, you know, it's on the board, pay attention. If you get it wrong, then it can be very, very dangerous. So as sort of the flip side of the, well, I mean, my decree says I have to go attack you here. Then there's the lazy version, which is the lizard cult, which is, all right, we have to stop this player. It's like, oh, I can't really attack them this turn. So I think that's all your problem. The lizards are kind of the opposite of the birds in that the birds are just these compounding forces. They start out with a couple of weak actions and they just start doing more and more and more and more. The lizards, as a general rule, can't do much, but when they do it, oh, they do it real well. And they have a different attitude towards resources. Most people have to spend cards. The lizards just have to show cards most of the time. So they're building this perfect hand and leveraging that. And then wishing that they had a little bit more flexibility in terms of their military operations. But alas, the great thing about the lizards also is that because they're so limited, the game throws them a bone in that the moment you build a building, their buildings are gardens, it is assumed, therefore, that you just control that clearing flat. Doesn't matter how many pieces you have. There's like 1,000 pilgrims coming to and from the gardens. It belongs to the lizard cut now. And on top of that, this is going to be a recurring theme for a number of my favorite factions. I like the art for the lizards great. They're just so enthusiastic about those skulls that they hold. They're just like, look, I get this skull. Isn't it great? And everyone's like, yeah, buddy, that's wonderful.
They embrace who they are.
Yeah, they know who they are. They love it, absolutely. So for me, it's the lizard cult. I love that lizard cult.
Just briefly, because I forgot to talk about it, the leaders for the bird people is a very interesting mechanism as well.
True.
You have this sort of hand of leaders, and they sort of represent each generation. It's like, okay, well, once that goes into disarray and dies off, then you start a new generation
of
birds.
A new dynasty, yeah.
A new dynasty, and it has this new leader. So figuring out the order in which to play these leaders is also interesting anyway.
It's true.
Let us move on to Marco Polo, another game that has crazy asymmetry and broken powers. Mark, who's your favorite character?
My favorite character is Johannes Caprini. Across all the expansions, Johannes Caprini is my favorite. The Voyages of Marco Polo has this system whereby movement, getting from city to city, is one of the key aspects of doing well. It both sets up your future economy as well as gives you endgame bonuses as a general rule. But it's extraordinarily expensive and difficult. And there are these silly oases in the way. Oases. And they just get in your way. They just serve to sock up your movement. Well, Johannes Caprini, his power is he can move from any oasis to any other oasis. And when you first hear that power, I'm not going to argue that everything in The Voyages of Marco Polo is perfectly balanced, but when you first hear that power, you're thinking, oh, movement's going to become trivial. Not quite. The Oases are set up in such a way that it definitely helps him move. That is absolutely his advantage. He is more flexible in movement than other characters. It's still really hard, but you end up jumping around the map in cool and interesting ways, whereas everyone's sort of trapped in a linear progression. I really enjoy Johannes Caprini. He's my favorite character in Voyages of Marco Polo.
Mine is Rasid Adilasan. He's the guy that lets you turn the dice to whatever you want.
Yes.
Because
I still remember that game we played at Chuck's. Oh, my goodness.
The aggravating part, sometimes in Marco Polo, is not getting the dice you want. You roll these dice, and it's sort of a dice worker placement, and you place them out. But you can get some very interesting combinations with this particular person, because you might happen to get into a nice gold sort of exchanging gold for points, and he can just say, well, I think I'm going to make these all sixes and get all the gold.
Yeah, I'm going to put three dice here. They're all sixes, yeah.
And then I'm going to turn this other one to a six so I can exchange six of this gold for all of the victory points.
Yep.
Might seem broken, but it's not always the greatest. You still have other, you know, because the other, I shouldn't say that's all you get to do, but that's your one trick, is the dice, where other characters also have
Let me ask you a question, though. I remember that game we played. We played it with Mark Posada from Board Game Barrage, friend of the show. And you were completely wiping the floor with us. We were still doing our thing, right? It's just you were scoring so many more points. But that was more or less all you got to do on your turn.
Yes, yes.
You'd spend three dice to get the gold, another die to turn the gold into something else, and I think the last die you typically got money or something else. That seemed less enjoyable than certainly what we got to do with our special powers. And it was definitely powerful. I'm not accusing you of, you know, having broken the game or anything, but was that really as satisfying? Were the points enough of a gratification?
No, it was the sort of how that game worked out because of where that gold exchange happened to be. Could have been further along. It could have been more accessible to other people where they could have just thrown a die in.
Yeah, sure. You did work for it. You did set that up. It didn't fall from the sky. It's true.
And like you said, it does. Then even if you do not get that sort of combination, there could be another fun game where you are making a lot of the deliveries because you can really work that market with those dice, right? So you can start working the market. So there's different ways you can go.
That's true.
Just enjoy playing him because you don't have to worry about your dice.
And it's also worth noting in The Voyages of Marco Polo, there are reasons why you don't want to turn your dice into sixes all the time. There are contexts in which you don't, but frequently he does.
And moving on, last but not least, we have Claustrophobia, which only has two choices. We might have picked the same one here.
It's
Who knows?
Entirely possible, yes.
That being said, let's cover one other thing quickly. Did you look at I was looking at the first edition of Claustrophobia when I was doing this sort of dive in.
Yep.
And if you had to get rid of one of your copies of Claustrophobia, which one would it be? Would you keep your first edition or would you keep the second edition?
I kept the second edition. I'll tell you why. Because I was able to find somebody who wanted the first edition very, very badly. And so I was able to gratify that desire. And because I do enjoy a number of the gameplay improvements of Claustrophobia 1643. I do miss aspects of the first edition, though, very profoundly.
I am sure that if I played them both again, I would agree with everything you just said. But looking back at how it had like the sort of plastic tray where the dice sucked in and the little pegs,
yep,
you know, and all the painted...
Ripped straight from Formula D.
Yeah, ripped. And all the painted figures and how... And I was like, oh, I remember that. And then the stark, you know, white, red, black of this new Claustrophobia.
It's very dish style, yeah.
With no paint. Anyway. Claustrophobia, you have one side that is a sort of, you have a religious leader, a priest, that sort of rounds up some prisoners called the Condemned. And
on a purely voluntary basis.
Yes. And asks them nicely.
They engage in a completely non-colonial excursion into the underworld.
To which they come willingly. They
yes,
want to
everyone,
help. Yes.
It's all sunshine and hugs.
Yes.
Until the indigenous demons, for no good reason whatsoever, take umbrage at this incursion.
Yes.
It's very rude of them.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
So yes.
By the way, we are joking, but it is very clear from the text of the game that the humans are the bad guys.
Yes.
Just to stress.
So yeah. So you take this party of criminals led by the priest, which Never mind. Moving on.
Yeah, yeah.
They go down to the underneath the city to fight these demons, and it's a fantastic skirmish two-player game where, like I said, the one side are the prisoners and the other side are the demons. Totally different mechanisms, totally on how they
play. Yeah, they're both dice-driven, but they both play different dice games to activate and drive their forces, yeah.
So who did you pick, Mark?
I prefer playing as the humans.
I also pick the Condemned, just because it has that sort of, you know, the B-list players, right? It's the riffraff of the prisoners, and they sort of on their last legs, and they're doing what they can to sort of... I'm not sure if they get totally pardoned or they reduce sentences or...
They never make it out alive. What are you talking about? Sure.
They're just fighting for their families and you know, they're doing their best.
It has a very strong Space Hulk vibe. Absolutely. And I will say that playing as the demons in Claustrophobia, I find more satisfying than playing as the Terminids in... Tyranids.
Gene Stealers.
Yeah, Gene Stealers, I remember. I'm sorry. I'm not despite my enthusiasm for Space Hulk, I'm not really down on the lore. But the Gene Stealers, playing as the Gene Stealers in Space Hulk is fine, but I don't find it as involved or interesting as playing as either the Space Marines or as demons in Claustrophobia. And I really like how it's kind of a tactical spatial puzzle and exactly what I want. You have to lock down all the possible spawn points. As the map gets bigger and bigger, it gets harder and harder and harder to do that. And the demons start seeping in and you feel like you're going to be overwhelmed. You just have to finish the mission objectives before you get overwhelmed. It's very Space Hulk-y and very satisfying.
Agreed. Why aren't we playing Claustrophobia more, Mark?
We should be playing Claustrophobia more. We've commented before that we play too many two-player games. There are not enough two-player games to play.
Yes.
And we have too many opportunities to play them.
Yeah, it's true. And it's just you and I sitting around looking for a two-player game. It's mostly just us staring deeply into each other's eyes.
Maybe that's why we didn't get around to it.
And then the session ends and it's like, oh, well, maybe next time we'll think of something to play.
Completely uncoincidentally, our OnlyFans has been doing very well lately.
It's true.
Yeah. So what other games did you decide to think about in terms of your favorite factions, Walker?
Oh, I have some other ones. Spirit Island, I know is you enjoy very much.
Really?
Well, just because... Well,
I didn't know you had any opinions on it.
I was just thinking of Spirit Island.
Sure.
And how... And it's not so much my own, but listening to other people talk. I listen to you and Huey, Dewey, talking about Spirit Island and how the different spirits work together.
Sure.
And
I am on record as preferring hashtag best spirit. Shadows flicker like flame.
And also made me like look around behind me at the collection. And it's sort of like what we talked about with Food Chain Magnet or Blood Rage. There's a game that I really love called Level 7 Invasion, where it is a troops on the map game, and it has that one mechanic that I always dream of where you can upgrade your army, and you can upgrade your army in different ways, and you sort of like spend these, you know, very hard to get resources, and now your army's better. It's like a pandemic type game where all of these invaders are coming in, and you got to do your best to beat them back while the scientist races around the world to help you finally defeat the alien invasion.
Is there a favorite upgrade you want to talk about?
Mostly just the one that improves your dice roll, because it is very much a game where you're rolling dice, and a little bit like, you know, Uprising of the Last Emperor, you could really flub a roll. So anything that lets you help you, you know, modify those dice is the best way to go.
Do you have a favorite HeroScape unit?
I have HeroScape here as well, Mark.
Splendid. What is your favorite HeroScape unit, Walker?
I really think it is the robots, the mech type. You know,
oh, the Soulborgs?
Robotech, yeah.
Do you like the ones that self-destruct, or do you like the other ones?
No, just the shooty ones.
The shooty ones,
yeah.
Sure. My favorite unit is the 10th Regiment of Foot, the Redcoats.
Yeah, very nice.
They're very cool. They have a bonus to shooting if they don't move. They have a bonus to melee if they do move, and so there's this interesting dynamic going on. And frankly, I just felt good that they were introduced because they were a repaint of the 4th Massachusetts line. But like many Canadians, the American Revolutionary War doesn't really hold much appeal to me. So
having a giant mob of zombies is always fun, too.
I never liked the zombies in HeroScape. I respect the design work they did with them, but they weren't really some of my favorite to field. I realize I'm in the minority on that one. Yeah, it was either going to be the 10th Regiment of Foot or Krug. Krug is the one who does more damage the more he's wounded. Krug is great.
Yes, the troll Krug is great.
Yes.
I also have the defensive Parseon 3 here just because it's, you know, high on the asymmetry and
sure.
Humans versus aliens again.
And what faction is your preferred?
I think it's, once again, the humans. You know, it's always, you know, you're behind the eight ball. You're defending your world against the vicious aliens.
Why you gotta be so racist about
it? I don't know.
It wasn't even...
I'm sorry.
Wait, why their world? It's Procyon 3. Huh? We don't know who got there first.
No, I'm pretty sure it's you know, it's obviously ours.
I have two cosmic games I want to talk about. There's Cosmic Frog.
I'm sure.
My favorite Cosmic Frog is the Ravager, based purely on the artwork. The Ravager in Cosmic Frog is the one that's living its best life. It's there. It's got a whole bunch of rocks. It's eating the rocks. It's loving those rocks, Walker.
It is.
Anytime Ravager comes up, I always try to get Ravager just because of the enthusiasm.
That is another interesting way to look at asymmetry as well, because every frog is different.
Yep.
But you change in the middle of the game.
Exactly.
Right? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. The dynamic is wonderful. It's one of the many reasons why we made Cosmic Frog Game of the Year. Yes. Jennifelli is some sort of frog savant. Not in any way to imply that she's not good at other things as well. And also, Cosmic Encounter. So Cosmic Encounter makes a bunch of references to a bunch of different sci-fi properties, but there's only one alien where they very explicitly made a reference to the greatest game ever made, Star Control 2. And that is the Hate. The Hate in Star Control 2 are the Dinyari from Star Control 2, the talking pets. And it not only is it a marvelous artistic reference, but it's also a really cool power. It helps you cycle cards. At the top pop of your turn, you can discard a card, and everyone else has to discard an equivalent or better card, or they lose a whole bunch of ships. And so you can just use it for card cycling to get rid of garbage. You can use it in a targeted way, knowing that another player has a really obnoxious flare that you want them to lose, so you discard one of your flares and they lose it, or a number of other ways. I love the Hate. I love the Hate. What can I say?
Another game we could talk about would be Captain Sonar, because
it's
not a game where, like, you know, you're playing the game slightly differently or whatever. You have a totally different job than everyone else at the table. I think my favorite one is mapping out how the enemy is moving and trying to figure out where on the map they are.
Oh, really? That's the part that sends me into conniptions.
Yes.
The only role that I can do in Captain Sonar is engineering. Just systematically crossing off systems as we move.
A little puzzle game, yeah.
Yeah, it's a series of pain management decisions. Those I can do, but the overall spatial puzzle where you have to try to figure out where people are, it's just completely beyond my capability. I just wasn't able to do it. I did have a moment that I very much appreciated during Gen Con, though, when Captain Sonar was being introduced. And that was, I was told at one point by the person running the game, okay, now you have to tell your opponents one true thing and one lie. And I said, the universe is just and your parents love you.
Nice.
And just watching that, because he was a young guy. He was like 17, 18. And he was like, just wait, what if I, oh no. And it just gradually sank in. I felt great about that.
You would. You're a monster.
Oh. Well, no, I do think, and for what it's worth, I do think that's true. I think that one of those is true. I don't think the universe is just, and I'm willing to bet odds are good that his parents love him. So, I mean, maybe that was false too. Who knows? But generally speaking, it's a safe bet.
Now, Cry Havoc came out before Root, I think. And so it was like the very first sort of conflict-y type when you have units that work completely different.
Well,
than
the very first, but yeah.
No, but yeah, you know what I mean. The most modern-y type one. And I thought the very first few games of Cry Havoc were fantastic for me. And I think the Wizards were my favorite faction there. Yeah. It's been so long since I played it. I can't remember what they did exactly, but they were fun.
Wizards. Do you have a favorite Guards of Atlantis character?
I have Guards of Atlantis here as well. Bear.
Bear? When in doubt, choose Bear. Yeah. Or Safar the Savage. I kind of suspected you'd choose Bear. You're very good with Bear. My favorite character is Sabina. I was much better with Sabina in first edition because then she was a little overpowered and tailored to my preferences. Second edition Sabina, I'm not nearly as good with her, but I still very much like her kit, like her vibe. She's about manipulating the minions, so to move them around, to get them in positions, to get stronger based on the minions, things like that. I'm definitely more successful with the Bird Samurai. I can murder people like crazy with Bird Samurai, but Sabina is my favorite character.
Next up, I think a game that is interesting is Pandemic. Because at this point, there are so many different characters that you can start the game with.
Absolutely.
And they've done such a great job of making them all so different and all so useful. There's not one that you'd take and say this, you know, you have to take this every time, like
right.
In Sentinels, it's like, oh, Legacy, you know. When in doubt, Legacy.
Sure, sure.
So anyway, I think the one I I should have looked it up because I can't remember. I think it's the Epidemiologist, the one you get to leave tokens in territories as you go, and then it just automatically kills sickness when it appears there.
Yeah, those are really good. I like the Operations Expert. Some people argue that the Operations Expert is overpowered. The Operations Expert is the one that can set up research stations just as an action wherever they're standing. And research stations are just so useful in so many ways. They help you move. They help you cure diseases. In some contexts, they key off of other things as well. And just being able to do that with so much ease gives you something new in the toolkit that gives you a lot of flexibility.
I think that covers every one of the ones I have here.
Well, that's a good list. We like playing with toys. These are some of our favorite toys. And all of these are games we pretty much enjoy playing, and so it's great to be able to see the systems iterate in this way. We've talked a lot about asymmetry, but it was nice to dwell for a little bit on some of our preferred manifestations thereof. So thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. That's going to do it for this week. We hope to see you again soon. Please do take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby, and as always, thank you, Rules Explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.